B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Friday, November 1st, 2019. I've got lots of news to comment on today. And I want to begin by thanking you for clicking on this podcast and pumping it into your earbuds or however you listen. So today, the candidate with a plan, Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, detailed how she would pay for Medicare for All. And this is a silly question that has been used to try to put her on the defensive throughout the televised debates that have occurred to date. And it has been used to pit Warren and Sanders, the progressives in the race, against the conservatives who are opposed to Medicare for All, opposed to free tuition, and many of the programs that were championed by Bernie Sanders in 2016 and are basically the core elements of the appeal of Democratic candidates heading into 2020. And so, predictably, the critics have pounced, and we'll get to that in a moment. Let's outline Elizabeth Warren's plan briefly, because like all of these plans, they have to work through Congress. The Democrats have to get elected first. They need to hold on to their majority in the House and maybe even take over the Senate, you know, and the White House, too. So all of this is contingent on if. But the media treats it as if these plans are, you know, carved in stone like the Ten Commandments. And even the New York Times mischaracterizes by saying Warren has been under pressure from top rivals like Biden to release details about paying for her biggest Medicare for All plan. Now, the pressure has come from the media. You remember there's this guy Delaney. We haven't heard from him in ages. I don't think he dropped out of the Democratic primary races. But he's like a backbench congressman, former congressman from Maryland, and he's conservative. So in the early debates, he was the foil. More recently, it has been Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, Biden to some extent, and Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado who's barely showing up in the polls at all. And this is an attempt by the corporate media to paint Biden and Warren as crazy, loony liberals who can't count and who are proposing pie in the sky. This is all part of the effort to demonize progressives and to try to prevent Warren or Sanders from becoming president. So, Warren's plan is tagged at $20 trillion in new federal spending. The total price tag over 10 years, all these are over 10 years, is in the $30 trillion range. 34 is a number from the Urban Institute. But get this, I spent a couple of minutes listening to some conservative nuts on my local radio station this morning. They had just gotten a hold of the Warren proposal, and they described it as $50 trillion. And, you know, these numbers are really crazy because they're never put in context of how much we're already spending on health care and how the outcomes are not competitive with other nations around the globe. So all of this, again, is, if. But Warren's outline is that she would pay for it by requiring employers to pay the government a similar amount to what they're currently spending on their employees' health care. And this protects the union members that Biden says would get screwed if they're provided with free health care and their employers are let off the hook. I think that's smart. She would change how investment gains are taxed, that's capital gains, on the top 1% of households, raising about $2 trillion over 10 years. She would expand her signature wealth tax proposal to be even a deeper bite on billionaires, raising another $1 trillion over 10 years. Create a tax on financial transactions like stock trades, that's a Sanders idea, bringing in $800 billion, and $800 billion in cuts to military spending. Well, I support all of these theoretical ways to pay for her Medicare for All package. But, of course, Pete Buttigieg, who has called her extremely evasive. He doesn't support this. And Joe Biden trotted out Kate Bedingfield, a deputy campaign manager, calling the plan unrealistic, said the required contribution from employers would fall on American workers. Not if it's written properly. And not if you maintain the deduction that employers enjoy for those expenses. And so they're taking pot shots here. They operate out of context. They never talk about the uninsured. They don't talk about the people who go bankrupt because of a major medical event in their lives. So along with her proposal, Warren issued a series of statements. Healthcare is a human right. We need a system that reflects our values. That system is Medicare for All. A key step in winning the public debate over Medicare for All will be explaining what the plan costs and how to pay for it. The proposal comes on top of roughly $5 trillion in new taxes that Warren had already advocated to cover a range of new programs. Now, let's just put this in the right frame. Trump gave away $1.6 trillion per year, $16 trillion over 10 years, using this the common math that they apply here. But see, we don't get that as a marker. And the effort is to threaten the middle class, that their taxes will go up. Michael Bennett of Colorado is right there with a statement. Voters are sick and tired of politicians promising them things they know they can't deliver. Warren's new numbers are simply not believable and have been contradicted by experts. And this battle inside the Democratic Party makes the Republicans happy. It also makes the health insurance companies and Big Pharma happy because they know that they've got good Democrats out there pleading their cause and doing their level best to prevent cutting out the insurance industry and cutting down Big Pharma to size. And this is gratuitous, but Nancy Pelosi gave an interview to Bloomberg News. I have a brief quote here. Pelosi: I am not a big fan of Medicare for All. Well, that's not very helpful. And it just shows how Democrats are captured by corporate interests. And fundamentally, that starts with where they raise their campaign cash. So, Warren drops this at a specific moment when a new poll of voters in Iowa shows that Joe Biden has slipped to fourth place. It's almost a dead heat between Warren, Sanders, and Buttigieg in the top three. Warren, 22, Sanders, 19, Buttigieg, 18, and it's a 3% margin of error. Interestingly, Amy Klobuchar, the Midwesterner who expected Iowa to be a good bounce for her, showing 4%. Kamala Harris, who told a colleague, Mazie Hirono, she said, I'm fucking moving to Iowa. Well, hasn't fucking done much to help her. And Andrew Yang is bringing up the rear there in the list with 3%. So, you know, the person who should be most worried here is Joe Biden. I got four very desperate fundraising emails from the Biden campaign yesterday, the end of the month. Only one from Bernie Sanders. But he has less than $9 million in cash on hand. His poll numbers are crashing. And Joe Biden, I think, will be out of the race, I think, by the end of this year. Then the pollsters looked at voters' second choices, which is interesting. And this gives an advantage to Senator Warren. She is the first or second preference of 47% of Iowa Democrats. Sanders is the first or second of 34%. Buttigieg at 31%. And Biden is at 28%. Only 1 in 10 voters name him as their second choice. So the situation is still very fluid, but this snapshot does give us an indication that Biden is fading and that the progressives with the big, bold ideas are capturing the attention of Iowans, along with the fresh-faced conservative, Pete Buttigieg. While we're talking about polling, and you know, I don't put a lot of stock in this, but I think some of these snapshots of public opinion are useful. A new Washington Post ABC News national poll shows that 49% of Americans say that Trump should be impeached and removed from office. And a fairly solid 47% say he should not. Now, the numbers have improved in recent weeks with the focus on Ukraine Gate and the sharper definition of the impeachment inquiry. But look at this. 82% of Democrats support removing Trump from office. 13% are opposed. Among Republicans, 82% want him to stay. 18% are in favor of his removal. So as long as those numbers hold, and as long as the Republicans remain in lockstep, there is a big fight ahead. And again, I am not convinced that the Ukraine narrative, and I don't dismiss it. I think that there was a quid pro quo, and it is proven not by the transcript of the call alone, and it's not a transcript, it's a memo, but also by the testimony we've gotten that it was very clear that Zelensky would not be invited to visit the White House until he coughed up some sort of investigation on the Bidens in Ukraine. Now, here's an interesting question from the poll here. 55% of Americans conclude that regardless of their views on impeachment, Trump did something wrong in his dealings with Ukraine. So some people are able to separate their political feeling from some sort of objective or intellectual analysis of what they see in the news. Meanwhile, yesterday's vote, which involved party lines except for two Democrats who voted with the Republicans, which gave the impeachment inquiry the imprimatur that Republicans have complained wasn't there. There's the promise of open hearings, of the possibility of lawyers to defend Trump and to interview the witnesses. But I remain convinced that the simplest proven case of Trump's criminal behavior is Michael Cohen's plea deal. And today, Pelosi, in that interview with Bloomberg, quote, did not rule out including instances of Trump's possible obstruction of special counsel Mueller's investigation into Russian election interference in articles of impeachment drafted by the House. There were 11 obstruction of justice provisions in the Mueller report, Pelosi told Bloomberg. Perhaps some of them will be part of this, but again, that will be part of the inquiry to see where we go. But Nancy, why can't you mention the proven episode? Michael Cohen is in jail because Donald Trump ordered him to commit a crime. And he did it for Trump's benefit. That is the clearest case. And it has to be among the articles of impeachment. I don't see how you can avoid it. But that's where things stand. This morning, I listened to Rush Limbaugh for 5 or 10 minutes, and I had to change the channel because he is just lying like crazy. He presents this picture of Trump having done nothing wrong. This is all just a cabal of Democrats trying to change the outcome of the 2016 election. And Limbaugh makes it out that all the Democrats are liars, but Trump is this virtuous man who is just a victim of the deep state, the Democrats, the liberal media. And there is some of that that's true. But he's a proven liar. And get this. Trump is now saying that he wants to go on television some night and give us all a little fireside chat where he wants to read what's quoted here as the full transcript of his phone call with the Ukrainian president. Now, he always refers to it as a transcript, but the document itself calls it a memorandum, a reconstruction of the conversation, and it explicitly says it is not verbatim. So in an interview with, who did he talk to? Oh, the Washington Examiner. Trump shifted from calling the phone call perfect to saying it was a good call. Then he said, at some point I'm going to sit down, perhaps as a fireside chat on live television, and I will read the transcript of the call, because people have to hear it. When you read it, it's a straight call. Well, I don't agree with that. I have read the transcript. It's edited. And if we get the full transcript and he reads it, it's going to be even more damaging. He also proclaimed his innocence. Everybody knows I did nothing wrong. Bill Clinton did things wrong. Richard Nixon did things wrong. But they did things wrong. I did nothing wrong. Oh, yeah? I want to thank Paul Leto. He's trained in the law. And he sent me a couple of text messages responding to Louie Gohmert, the nutball Republican congressman from Texas. He, I think, is a former judge. He's a bizarre guy. And in comments yesterday, he threatened that impeachment is going to produce civil war. And Leto notes that this is a strategy. The threats of civil war helping Trump to get the case into the Supreme Court, at least to slow it down, if not decide the case in part. This plays into Trump's new ad in which he argues Dems are just out to get him while he is trying to get things done. So he argues one of the broadest latitudes of due process is the right to argue one's theory of the case. So yes, the Dems should give him more rights, a fair trial, and then hang him. The more streamlined due process, grounded as it is in the Clinton and Nixon practices that were never appealed, is not going to be considered due process if the court is persuaded to take the case. We can't stop appeals to the court. We can only hope they don't decide to take the case, but there is a way to argue for a review here if the alternative is civil war. So they are creating that reality. And Paul Leto gave us an interview a couple of weeks ago about his witnessing of the massive leak of crude oil and gas effluent bubbling up under the ground at an oil facility where he used to work in North Dakota. And the latest news from North Dakota is that the Keystone Pipeline system has a new leak. About 400,000 gallons of crude oil near the small town of Edinburgh in northeast North Dakota. It's an uninhabited area, and the wetland is not a source of drinking water. But it just shows that the claims that the pipelines are so safe and that the water of the Standing Rock protesters was never at any risk, well, I don't believe that. Somehow, I don't think you do either. Every day, I pause for a minute to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And I want to thank Joe Carson, Paul Karsh, Abby McMillan, and Wendy Gebauer. They kick in $10 or $20 a month, and I really appreciate their support. You can do it, too. Visit peterbcollins.com. There's a menu button. Click on that, then click on Become a Subscriber. You'll hit the sign-up page, and it's easy to make a decision about the level of support you're comfortable in committing to. And if you don't like PayPal, you can address your correspondence to my P.O. Box, number 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Well, today I'm releasing to those subscribers a fresh, in-depth interview that's very timely. I talk with Johanna Bozowa, who is the co-manager of climate and energy programs at the think tank called the Democracy Collaborative. And she wrote a piece in The Nation, published just about a week ago, calling for public ownership of the rogue and bankrupt Pacific Gas and Electric Company utility. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Johanna Bozowa.
Well, I completely agree. I'm also an advocate for public power. I think that this is a public service and it should be in the hands of the public. PG&E has proven that they can't provide this service, and they have held a chokehold over the legislature. They have had regulatory capture over the PUC there, and all the other reasons we've just stated why we need to shift and we need to think about new ownership structures that are going to allow for that. And in California, actually, there is quite a robust amount of public ownership that's already taking over a large portion of the energy system through what is called community choice aggregation, which is where counties or a collection of cities can come together to create, to take over the generation of the energy. And this is often used as a strategy to move much more rapidly towards renewable energy at much lower rates.
That's Johanna Bozowa, talking about public ownership of PG&E. It's a fascinating conversation, and it's available for my subscribers today and all through the weekend at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, and Stitcher. Well, as I speak to you today here, 1 week after the arrest of journalist Max Blumenthal in Washington for bogus charges related to his coverage of the occupation of the D.C. Embassy of Venezuela earlier this year, I can tell you that a Google search shows no mainstream media coverage at all. I went through the list with you yesterday, and the same people, including yours truly, are the ones who show up having covered this despicable arrest of a journalist. And this is detailed further by Alan McLeod over at Mint Press News. And he puts it in a larger context, quoting our friend Lee Camp, the comedian and TV host. This is the continued descent into a fascist state. When the U.S. government is arresting journalists in dramatic fashion, clearly because their reporting is threatening to the power elite, then what else can one call it? And when you couple this with the efforts to slow down or block traffic to progressive media sites like Consortium News, like Mint Press, like Truth Dig, Truth Out, my podcast, we've seen it over the last few years. And so there is a whole pattern. And Max Blumenthal's illegal arrest is the latest indignity. Oh, and they post some tweets here. Somebody named Margaret Kimberly says, let me know when or if the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker or Committee to Protect Journalists say anything about Blumenthal's arrest. So a response from U.S. Press Freedom Tracker. We are aware of Blumenthal's arrest, and based on the information available, it does not meet the threshold for categorization on our site because he was not in the course of reporting when it happened. Yeah, he was at home, either snoozing or having breakfast. And the incident where he is falsely accused of attacking a pro-Guaido protester at the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, he was on duty as a journalist. So this is a low point in American media and journalism. And I hope you will continue to spread the word that Max Blumenthal should be defended and not the subject of a media blackout. So Bernie Sanders went to J Street. J Street is the moderate Zionist advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. They're not as bad as AIPAC. And I present to you two coverages, two different perspectives of Bernie Sanders' visit there. Mehdi Hasan, writing at The Intercept, is generally positive, saying that Bernie Sanders had some strong comments. He said that my solution is to say to Israel, you get $3.8 billion every year. If you want military aid, you're going to have to fundamentally change your relationship to the people of Gaza. He went on, in fact, I think it's fair to say that some of that should go right now into humanitarian aid in Gaza. Now, I think those are good comments. They drew criticism from the predictable, like Nikki Haley, Trump's former UN ambassador. Just when you thought Sanders couldn't get any more radical, he outdid himself. He wants to take money we give to Israel to defend itself from terrorists and give it to Gaza, which is run by terrorists? Unreal. Why isn't every other Dem-Prez candidate saying he's wrong? Now, there are additional quotes here. Sanders told Mehdi Hasan, Gaza is experiencing a humanitarian and environmental crisis. Conflating an effort to address that crisis with support for Hamas is part of an effort to dehumanize Palestinians and continue the conflict. As I've said many times, Sanders continued, we need an even-handed policy in the Middle East which guarantees Israel's right to exist in peace and security and which treats the Palestinian people with respect and dignity. Now, Hasan is not totally blind to Sanders' weaknesses on foreign policy. But he does note that he's better than all of the Democratic candidates, and I think that is fair. The other piece I invite you to read is written by Miko Pellet. I've interviewed Miko. He is the son of an Israeli general. And he took a far more critical view of Sanders' appearance at J Street. I don't have it printed out to cite for you right now, but I have a link in the show file for the podcast for you to review it, and I invite you to compare those different perspectives, and you can probably reach your own. Also, I want to recommend an op-ed published at The Guardian today under the byline of Hamilton Nolan, and I haven't heard of Hamilton before. He's described as a writer based in New York City, and if I got the gender wrong there, Hamilton, you have my apology. At any rate, Hamilton writes, 4 decades of growing inequality and class war by the rich that has been too successful for its own good have pushed Americans toward political positions that would have been considered fringe back in the 1990s. And he says that what we have here is, his headline reads, Why Are Democratic Party Elites So Desperate for a 2020 Centrist Candidate? He writes, Joe Biden, the establishment centrist Democrat candidate of choice, is weak. He's old. He's showing clear signs of age-related mental decline. He's an uninspiring speaker. He's out of touch. And he can't raise money from small donors. The candidates who can raise that money are Sanders and Warren. Unsurprisingly, the two people whose policies are most suited to our current reality. The last thing that the centrist Democratic Party establishment, a power structure still rooted in the triangulating ideas of the Clinton era, wants our policies suited to our current reality, because the radicalism of such policies would necessarily place the old guard in the trash. And so the old guard must desperately pine for a savior. Oprah repeatedly begged Disney chief executive Bob Iger to jump in the race. Hillary Clinton backers hint darkly that she might still jump in. For those who crave an even more decrepit candidate, Mike Bloomberg and John Kerry's names have been floated. You get the point. One more quote. For decades, the Democratic Party has been effectively controlled by the sort of people who work at an investment bank but also support gay marriage. These people are almost as responsible as Republicans for our current political predicament. Even if they didn't start the war on terror or the war on the poor, they utterly failed to stop them. The time has come to pay up for those mistakes, and the price will be a large chunk of the fortunes that have been built over the past 2 generations. Superheroes don't exist. Some good points there. And finally today, from the Foreign Desk, there are too many protests going on around the world for me to keep tabs on all of them. But in Baghdad, Iraq's president has caved to the anti-government protesters who've been in the streets almost every day, and they called for a drafting of a new election law. The president said he would approve early elections once it's enacted, and this was one of the demands of the protesters. They want a clean sweep of government there, and similar demands are being made in Beirut, where, there have been some fig leaves offered. But the protesters want a total, total change. We talked about Baghdad. Hong Kong protests continue. Chile is a flashpoint. And Ecuador continues to see social unrest. And I believe this will continue for some time. And finally, I want to note that our good old Central Intelligence Agency is back in the news. During the U.S., big-time occupation of Afghanistan, we conducted night raids. This occurred mostly under the Bush administration. It was tapered off under Obama. But it really riled the public that U.S. forces would show up at a family compound at night and detain people, sometimes kill people. Well, in recent months, night raids have been on the uptick in Afghanistan. And the CIA-trained Afghan Special Forces, who appear to be under the control of the United States and not the government in Kabul, have been accused of atrocities. Human Rights Watch issued a new report saying that U.S.-backed Afghan Special Forces and rising civilian deaths by both American and Afghans are of concern. They call for an investigation into whether the U.S. has committed war crimes. The report says U.S.-led peace talks have omitted addressing the fate of the Afghan special forces that work as part of the covert operations of the CIA. Old game. Still going on. American imperialism. Your tax dollars at work. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I am Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.